Okay, we're good to start. Rabbi Yoelin.
Oh, where are you supposed to be?
Wait for the green light.
You're here to stay?
Yes.
Okay. So there's a medrash at the beginning of Parshas Pekudei that Moshe was counting all of the kesef HaMishkan so he could do a proper accounting, and he suddenly got nervous because he wasn't able to account for 1,775 of the shkalim, and those were the shkalim that were used for the Vavin La'amudin, for the hooks that went on the pillars. So the Medrash says, "Below Hayunirin," that he was looking around him and he couldn't see it because they were behind the curtains. But since they were on the pillars that were outside of the immediate Mishkan, the inner part of the Mishkan, so Heyer Hakadosh Baruch Hu Ezeinav, Hakadosh Baruch Hu opened up Moshe Rabbeinu's eyes, so he was able to remember the Vavin La'amudin. So Shimon Schwab and Mayim Beis Hashoeva explains that Moshe Rabbeinu was on the inside of the Mishkan because he was focused on the inner Kedusha and he wasn't able to see beyond the curtains. And he derives from this a very important Musar message that it's always important to pay attention to the people who are behind the curtains, to borrow a phrase a little bit from The Wizard of Oz, in contrast to pay no attention to the man behind the curtain. So we're supposed to pay attention to all the people who are behind the curtain. So this is not only true with respect to literally paying attention to the needs of those in our community who may be behind the mechitza curtain in various shuls, as we're going to speak about the role of women when it comes to issues of Jewish leadership and the like. But it's also important to look beyond the curtain in terms of being sensitive towards modern-day sensibilities. The Gemara in Erchin and Daf Tezayin, Darshin Sam Zedor Darshav Makshef Anecha Yaakov Zela, that there was a machlokes tanoim about how exactly we're supposed to approach the needs of each generation. Chana Mar Dor Lefi Aparnas, one says that according to the leadership of a generation, that's the way the people of the generation are going to be. Chana Mar Parnas Lefi Ador, and the other opinion says that no, you have to have leaders who are suited to the generation, to the people who are in the generation. That's how the leaders get selected. That's how we apply proper leadership. So Raviel Schwartz writes that really both opinions are correct. The way it's a symbiotic relationship between the leaders of a generation and the people of the generation. The people have to turn to the leaders for guidance, and the leaders have to be sensitive to the realities on the ground with respect to the people. So one rabbi called me up the other week, specifically talking about these issues of figuring out what are the boundaries, what are the guidelines when it comes to carving out women's positions of leadership, of authority, whatever you want to call them. And he said that he was afraid that if we take too hard a line, he said, "I'm afraid we're going to lose the millennials." He got all nervous. So I don't know exactly how he's defining millennials or what exactly that means 100%. But as Rav Soloveitchik said, I don't think we have to be so nervous. We don't have to worry about Torah ever losing its relevance. HaKadosh Baruch Hu saw to it that the Torah will be a permanent relevance and everlasting truth. Yistakel be'araisu bara alma. HaKadosh Baruch Hu looked at the world, all the generations of the world, when he fashioned the Torah. The world is subject to the rules of the Torah in every single generation, in every single society. Those rules never, ever change. So his fear is not one that I share per se. But I do think that the concern about resonating with the millennials, I don't know, what are we up to now? X generation, me generation, whatever. Z generation?
Z?
I don't know, okay. Whatever letter we're up to. But the concern about resonating with every single generation is correct, in the sense that the method of the messaging and the application of the Torah's immutable principles can in fact vary, from generation to generation. Rav Schwartz quotes the former Mashgiach Aponovich, Chaska Levenstein, that he said towards the end of his life, I don't know fully what to make of this statement. I think it was said in large part out of humility, but I think he was broadcasting a message. He said, Ani kfar eini shayach l'dor hazeh. Said, I already don't belong to this this generation. Like when I was growing up, we all used to read the Jewish Press. I think it's still around. Fine publication. And there was a weekly column by Arnold Fine, which he would always, I remember when. And he would say every single week, Shayin, it's a different world. It wasn't so different when he was writing the columns, but considering how different it is today, it's a very, very different world today. But the world is constantly changing. So one thing that has changed in the world that we see is that women more than ever before in the secular world assume positions of significant leadership. It's not unusual to find the woman who's a prime minister of a country. Right, England, I think, right now has a prime minister. Israel had a female prime minister a number of years ago, Golda Meir. Women are CEOs. They have become chief executive officers of corporations. They play very significant leadership, trailblazing roles in the general world. And they assume important positions in all of the professions. And the question is, well, does halacha then also adjust itself to those new realities? In the course of our own history, Jewish history, history of the Torah, women generally have not assumed positions of leadership that has been reserved for the men. We don't have Jewish queens. We have a pasuk, Som tasim alecha melech, melech v'lo malka. There was one during Bayis Rishon when we had the Malchus Beis David in place. So there was one woman who usurped the kingdom or the queenship, but she was not a righteous woman. It was taken by fiat, Atalia, Atalia the Hun. So she was not considered to be a shining example of how one conducts themselves in our tradition. So you can't bring rayos from there. Certainly it's Xavis Augusta, but women's not supposed to be appointed as a queen. So the question is, does anything change? So first of all, one very important piece of perspective to bear in mind when approaching this sugya is that even though it seems to be a subject that's a very heated and very contested and has the potential of tearing Teaneck apart or whatever else, this is really not a subject that should frighten us and terrify us, because this is still HaKadosh Baruch Hu's world. And we don't need to be frightened by the challenges that are presented. The poskim have always been able to look at the principles of the Torah and apply them to new situations, to new sociological realities, to new facts that are on the ground. Although we should always be wary of any movements that are fashioned that might be created for the purpose of undermining the Torah and our tradition, we don't need to be wary about our own people, about our men and our women, about all the members of Klal Yisrael. If there are new sociological realities that affect us as a nation and the totality of our people, we believe and we have a firm sense of confidence that the Torah is able to supply the answers. And if the answers aren't 100% clear, so maybe that means that the Torah is providing us with a certain amount of flexibility through which we are supposed to approach these issues as well. But even those flexibilities have their boundaries and have their parameters. But Moshe Feinstein writes that he has a tshuva in Orachaim Chelik Dalid Simon Memtes, which he speaks about Nashim She'ananot. We're going to have an easy translation for Nashim She'ananot. We'll call them trailblazing women, at least in the context of his tshuva. Trailblazing women who want to take upon themselves the observance of more mitzvot of the Torah than they're strictly commanded to perform. And Moshe Feinstein says that if it's being done out of a sense of l'shem shemayim, to come closer to a Kodesh Baruch Hu, then we could say matov manoim. But he said that, number one, there are still halakhic parameters that have to be observed. There are certain boundary lines that can't be crossed. And number two, it's important that it be done with a sense of respect for the Mesorah of the Torah, with a sense of reverence towards HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and not a sense that it's being done in order to right the wrongs of discrimination against women throughout the ages, because that's not really the Torah approach. If anything, the Torah endows women in our tradition with the same level of sanctity as of Kedusha as men. So it says, Kosamar leves Yaakov v'sagei levnei Yisrael, right? That's when the Torah was given. So Kodesh Baruch Hu spoke both to the Beis Yaakov, right, to all the women in seminary, v'sagei levnei Yisrael, and to all of the men. And the continuation of the Psukim say, V'atem tiyuli mamlachas kohanim begoy kadosh. You shall be for me a nation of kohanim and a holy people. So the women are just as holy as the men. Rav Soloveitchik explained that this is why we paskin like Rabbeinu Tam, the Ashkenazic tradition, that if a woman volunteers a mitzvah, she wants to shake lulav, even though she's not obligated, sit in a sukkah, though she's not obligated, hear the shofar, though she's not obligated. So a woman also makes a bracha over all of these mitzvahs. Why is that?
According
to Rabbeinu Tam, I said.
Oh.
According to Rabbeinu Tam, the way that we, the Ashkenazic community, paskins. Separate discussion within the Sephardic community. So the Rav explains that this is because the women have the same level of Kedusha. He says that the way he reads the Rambam is of the opinion that an Eved Knaini, for example, who has to have a tevila, a separate immersion in a mikveh, at the time that he becomes emancipated and becomes a full-fledged Jew, and according to the Rambam, the second tefila of an Eved Knaini, had one tefila when he became an Eved, but the second tefila is a tefila de Araisa. That's because the Eved, although he has the same level of obligation and mitzvot, a positive mitzvot as a woman that he's absolved, he's exempted from all time-bound commandments, mitzvot says that he should, if he would decide to volunteer them, he would not make a bracha, because he's not on the same level of Kedusha, doesn't yet have a full-fledged Yiddishkeit. But the women, just like the men, have a full-fledged Yiddishkeit, a full-fledged Kedushas Yisrael. So, Ramosha, when he talks about the proper motivations of there being a sense of wanting to grow closer to a Kodesh Baruch Hu in terms of Yiras Shamayim, so he says one litmus test of that is there has to be an understanding that there are certain mitzvahs that are off limits. The Shulchan Aruch Siman Lamed Ches, we paskin that women cannot volunteer, for example, to put on tefillin. If they want to be stringent upon themselves, we don't allow them. Tefillin, even with respect to men, is limited to certain times, requires gufnaki, so we do not allow people who are not otherwise obligated, the women who are not otherwise obligated, we don't allow them to wear tefillin. Somebody wants to abrogate what's written in Shulchan Aruch and say, oh, the woman, in order to be fully realized spiritually, needs to break down this barrier. So that's an indication, says Rav Moshe, that it's not really being done with the proper motivations and with the proper mindset. The proper mindset is that there has to be a reverence for the halacha. Gemara Baba Basa describes the Benos Slavkot as Chachmanios. They were very, very smart. So gives as an explanation of their intelligence that they would not have asked Moshe Rabbeinu for Yerusha to inherit their father had there been sons. So how is that smart? That just sounds like they were being submissive to whatever, you know, the Torah rules were. How does that indicate their intelligence? So it seems that when we speak about intelligence is defined according to our tradition in terms of having a deference for the structure of Torah and an appreciation for all of the Torah rules. That is how we define Chokmah. Chokmah has to be within the confines and the framework of Chokmah HaTorah, which means that if the Torah says that something is absolutely off limits, a part of the Chokmah of how one is able to fully grow and materialize their potential is through recognizing that they're bound by the norms of the Torah. Now, of course, as a general rule, we're working with a proposition that we have to figure out how to define proper roles and rules for women in the modern age who are completely the Shem Shemayim and who do defer to the framework of the Torah. I think that that should be the starting point. When your starting point is that you're going to be suspicious of 50% of Klal Yisrael, so that's not very constructive or very helpful. The starting point has to be that we have respect that everyone wants to serve a Kodesh Baruch Hu correctly, and we are not in any way overwhelmed by this, because we know that we just have to look to the Torah for the answers, and if we can't figure out the answers in a clear and unambiguous fashion, so we consult with the Gedolei Hador, and that everybody's on the same page, that we all want to do what's proper according to halakha, so that we can calm down. If people agitate and they don't want to go through the halakhic process of defer to the Gedolei Hador, then there's already something wrong with the picture. But I'm assuming that this is the general starting. This is the general starting point for our discussion. So, first of all, one area where there really has been a tremendous amount of change, a tremendous amount of growth, is in terms of women's learning of a Torah. There's much more structured education for women learning Torah nowadays. The Shulchan Aruch says, Isha Shalom de Torah Yesh Laskar. Could start off on that note that a woman who learns Torah, she receives a reward. Just that since she's not commanded in all facets of Torah learning, so she doesn't receive the same level reward that a man receives for learning Torah, because he's obligated, so he has a Yetzer Hara that he needs to overcome in order to learn Torah. But still, as the Beis Halevi points out, she does have the chiyuv to learn Torah, at least with respect to dinim hashayachim liisha, with respect to those laws that she is obligated to perform. She's only exempt from the additional level of Talmud Torah with respect to, you know, things that you learn, even though they may not necessarily be halacha lemaisa. So it's in this super gatari area that we have the discussion in Masechet Sota. Rabbi Eliezer Omer Kumalame Bito Torah Kilo Lamda Tiflus. Rabbi Eliezer says, we paskin like him in Shulchan Aruch, that if a father teaches his daughter Torah, so that it's considered like he's teaching her licentiousness, that it may not necessarily lead in a good direction, particularly since she doesn't have to learn everything, you just learn a little bit, so you can learn what seems like some of the loopholes without understanding more of the guidelines and restrictions and the strict rules. But even this halacha, which seems to place a huge limitation on women when it's codified in the Shulchan Aruch, there's already a lot of wiggle room that's built into the halacha. First of all, it's only an obligation incumbent upon the father that he's not supposed to teach his daughter Torah. It doesn't say that the daughter is prohibited from learning Torah on her own. Secondly, the way it's codified in the Shulchan Aruch is, this is Yerideya Simen Reish Mem Vav, Mnei Sherov Hanashim Ein Daitam Mikuvanas Lislamed, because most women are not necessarily suited for this type of learning. Number three, we have yet another limitation. The Rambam brings down this limitation or this idea that it's considered like it's teaching tiplus only applies to Torah Shebaal Peh. But as far as Torah Shebaktav is concerned, okay, so maybe lechatzkila lo yilamid ota, but in melamda, eno kemelamda tiflus. But if her father would teach his daughter, it wouldn't be considered like he's teaching her anything that would be untoward. And then finally, the Rama adds the final proposition that we mentioned already, In any event, a woman is obligated to learn those halakos that are relevant to her, meaning she needs to know brachos, she needs to know hilchos Shabbos, she needs to know hilchos yontif, she needs to know hilchos kashrus. It's hard to imagine, you know, why there would be any significant diminishment of teaching of Torah to women, given the starting point of the Ramah, that there's so much that women need to know already in terms of halacha. So based on all of these different carve-outs that exist within the halacha, the Torah was given to provide us this flexibility and wiggle room to be able to accommodate the needs and desires of women to learn Torah on a higher level. So the Prisha notes in his commentary to the Torah that Avon Lamda La'atzma Anuroin, that if a woman decides that she wants to learn Torah Shebaal Peh on her own, so we see she's not part of that majority that the Shulchan Aruch assumes would not be suited for Torah learning. So any woman that proves that she wouldn't be part of this, what we call Ruba Delesa Kaman, this majority presumption of individuals who would not be interested in learning Torah, she shows she is interested in learning Torah, so there would be no prohibition in her case from learning Torah or encouraging that interest that she has already manifested. The Torah Tamima has a further observation and insight in which she says, "Ulai nemar kishaab malamda bekatnusa." That maybe this entire prohibition is only when the woman is very young, when she's a little girl. When she's a little girl, you don't know if she's going to have an interest or not in Torah Shebaal Peh. But if she's already older, and she's, again, like the Prisha indicated, she's manifested an interest, and also we're able to tell that she's suited through her disposition and her demeanor and her decorum for this type of instruction, so then it can be perfectly appropriate. And he quotes from a sefer called Mayan Ganim, which he cites with a certain amount of accolades and respect. He refers it to a sefer Atik Yomin Yakar HaMitziyut HaNikra Mayan Ganim. If you look at the Torah Tamima's autobiography, or even the English translation, My Uncle the Netziv, you could see him go on for pages and pages in this vein, in which he talks positively about learned women throughout the centuries, including the Netziv's wife. And he says, "Amna manashim ashenadav liba nosana lekavel amalacha malachas Hashem mitzav b'chirasan b'tov b'mashu tov," that they found Torah and they found that it's good. "Hein heina talena be'ar Hashem," these women should rise up to the mountain of Hashem, tishkonu makom kachok in a shameful face. Heina, they are wonder women. This is the original Wonder Woman.
Who's this?
This is Mayan Ganim. No. I think he was from an early Akron period, 16th century or so. "V'chachmei doron, la'adron, la'hadron, l'sadron, l'chazik yedeyen, la'ametz rosein, v'chulei asi v'atzlichi v'nashamayim yisayuch." That they should be encouraged, they should be strengthened, they should be helped and facilitated towards their goal of growing in Torah. So certainly all of this remains consistent even with the letter of the law. Furthermore, the Chafetz Chaim went a step further, and in his commentary, Likutei Halakos, you have that in the materials, pages 32 to 33, he says that nowadays that women don't necessarily pick up all of the Torah instruction that they need in their homes. He was speaking about Europe of over 100 years ago. So he said that since they're not going to pick it up and they're going out to the schools and they're learning secular knowledge, they're learning language, and they're learning all kinds of secular wisdom. So if we're not going to teach them Torah in a structured environment, l'chatchila to teach them Torah Shebaal Peh, and also to throw in Musrei Chazal, Kagon Maseches Avos, or Sefer Menorah, Samor, Chedomeh, then they're not going to have a strong grounding in terms of their own frumkeit, and that's going to weaken the foundation of the Torah community altogether, because so much depends upon the women, the mothers who are bringing up the families, the mothers, the wives. So he says, "Kadeshi yisames etzla minyan emenusenu ha-kadosha, b'gitim lov hachi olu l'shiyasubu l'gamri, miderach Hashem, v'yavu ko yisodei adas chas v'shalom." If you don't do it, we're going to lose them. So the what was the thinking of the Chafetz Chaim? Was he abrogating the halacha? No, not at all. The Chafetz Chaim was demonstrating how the flexibility built into the halacha requires different applications based on different sociological circumstances, and it's not a bad thing for people to know Torah. Remember, a woman who learns Torah gets a sechar anyway. But I think that the Chafetz Chaim, and this is the way the Chafetz Chaim is understood by some, may have been focusing even upon the Ramah's guideline. What did the Ramah say? A woman is obligated to learn those laws that are necessary in order to keep mitzvahs. If by not having structured education and having Beis Yaakov schools and the like for the women, they're not going to end up keeping the mitzvahs. So any type of Torah instruction that's necessary to give them the requisite amount of Yiras Shemayim so that they're going to keep the mitzvahs properly is included within that provision of the Ramah. And that probably is what was guiding Rav Soloveitchik on some level when he took the Chafetz Chaim a step further. He was asked in 1953, this is going back over 65 years ago, by Rabbi Leonard Rosenfeld, who was then, I think, the head of the Board of Jewish Education in New York. And he wrote to the Rav, is it permissible to teach Torah Shebaal Peh to girls? Is it advisable to teach Torah Shebaal Peh to girls? And Rav Soloveitchik was first somewhat guarded in answering the question. He said, I don't want to answer the question right away unless I know for sure people are going to listen to me. And people have the right attitude. He said that there's a problem of two different groups, that there's one group of people, he said, that wanted to liberalize the law of the Torah entirely and make it subject to their own whims. And there are others who want to see the Torah fossilized and completely shut out of life. However, Rav Soloveitchik felt that neither of those approaches were consistent with the halacha and what was appropriate. And what is appropriate, said the Rav, is that we have to figure out how to dynamically apply the Torah to new situations and to new challenges. So the Rav eventually wrote back to Rabbi Rosenfeld, and he wrote that he felt that it was absolutely imperative same Torah instruction, which is made available for men, should be made available to women as well. I expressed my opinion to you long ago that it would be a very regrettable oversight on our part if we were to arrange separate Hebrew courses for girls. Not only is the teaching of Torah Shebaal Peh to girls permissible, but it is nowadays an absolute imperative. This policy of discrimination between the sexes as the subject matter method of instruction, which is still advocated by certain groups within our Orthodox community, has contributed greatly to the deterioration and downfall of traditional Judaism. Boys and girls alike should be introduced into the inner halls of Torah Shebaal Peh. You couldn't get away with writing something like this nowadays. But the Rav wrote this over 65 years ago. The Rav saw what was going on around him, that if you didn't have the same level of sophistication one moment, that would be made available to the boys and to the girls, then the girls who would be learning other secular studies and disciplines and professions on a very high level wouldn't have the same measure of respect for the teachings of the Torah. They wouldn't understand its ideological and philosophical underpinnings, and therefore they would not be able to reach the requisite level of Yiras Shamayim that would serve as the catalyst for them to properly observe a mitzvot. So therefore, the way that various family members of Rav Soloveitchik explain this opinion, you find this a little bit in the writings of Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, of Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, excuse me, you find this a little bit in the writings of our own Rabbi Meir Twersky as well, is that the Rav was really drawing upon the same idea of what the Ramah had said. You must teach the women whatever it takes in order for them to perform mitzvahs. And if that means teaching them Torah Shebaal Peh in order to enable them to develop the Yiras Shamayim, so that has to be part of the picture. But as Rabbi Twersky pointed out, I just wanted to say this word, our community is polychromatic. And since it is polychromatic, Therefore, what may be necessary or appropriate in one venue or in one community may not necessarily be appropriate or necessary in a different community. So the Rav wasn't necessarily saying that in every single Haredi setting this had to be the mode of instruction for the girls. It really depends upon the societal setting and what other type of instruction, what other types of influences the women in question, the girls in question, would be receiving. But based on whatever those influences may be, it certainly stands to reason that there would be certain communities and certain settings, certainly many within our own communities, where Torah Shabbat Peh instruction for women would be appropriate, at least on some level. Yes?
Are there any of these shitas hold that it's permitted for the women to learn even what's not halacha l'maaseh b'lamda?
100%. That's when the Rav was talking about Torah Shabbat Peh. He was going beyond that which the Ramah strictly was saying in terms of halacha l'maaseh, just in terms, it could be even kachim v'taros, in terms of the nitty-gritty of Torah Shabbat Peh. Yes?
The halachic briefing that the Rav said he hoped to prepare in the future, is that available in the public domain?
No, I have never seen it, but they, you know, every year another 5 or 10 books of the Rav get published, so who knows, maybe we'll, you know, still merit to see it, but I don't know if it was actually ever written. That's a good question for family members. I don't know.
Did the Chofetz Chaim advocate only halacha l'maaseh, also kachim v'taros?
Well, again, I'm noting that the Rav did not limit his discussion to halacha l'maaseh. That wouldn't have been a chiddush for the Rav to have said halacha l'maaseh. Of course, even the boys are not necessarily being taught in such a deep level of kachim v'taros. What I mean to say is that even the possibility of Gemara learning, there's the famous picture of the Rav going down to, you know, Stern College and teaching a shiur on Gemara. I don't know that it was geared per se in halacha l'maaseh. The Rav was just saying that a certain dose of Torah Shebaal Peh could be appropriate and beneficial towards building up the necessary Yirah Shemayim, necessary connection with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, the necessary engagement with Torah that is certainly obligatory for us to provide to both boys and girls who are growing up. This is independent of the Prisha's observation that if a woman on her own demonstrates that she's interested in mastering Kol HaTorah Kula and learning Torah Shebaal Peh on a very deep level, even if it's not halacha l'maaseh, that certainly is something which is laudable and appropriate and consistent with, you know, what the Torah Tamima quoted from the Mayan Ganim as well. But then this leads us to the next question, which is, if the woman has the learning and she has the training, what about community leadership positions? What about a woman serving as Skowin resident, serving as a Yoetzet Halacha, serving as a rabbi, and all of these other questions that have arisen in addition to other types of communal roles as women become more publicly engaged in general? What about having a female shul president and things of that variety? So the starting point for that discussion is a recognition that leadership is not a value per se in halacha. Moshe Rabbeinu resisted for 7 days when HaKadosh Baruch Hu tapped him to be the all-time leader of Klal Yisrael. We know the famous story in Horios when Rabbi Gamliel wanted to appoint two young Talmudic scholars to a position of leadership within the community, and they refused to come to him because of their tremendous modesty. And he said, do you think that I'm giving you a position of glory? My goodness, this is a Jewish communal position. This is a position where you're going to be reviled and attacked on a very regular basis. It's a position of avdus. So we don't view leadership per se as a laudable or lofty type of thing to assume. And also we have a principle of Atznei Alecha Sim Hashem Elokecha. As Gemara in Sukkah says, even on public occasions, we're supposed to conduct ourselves with modesty and with privacy. So even men who are allowed to assume positions of leadership as a general rule are not supposed to covet positions of leadership. And in the case of women, there's the additional consideration of Kol Kevuda Bas Melech Penima, that the glory of a princess is within the palace. The Gemara in Yevamah, Staf Ayin Vav, and Mabay, Staf Ayin Zayin, and Aleph even learns that an important halacha from this principle of Moavi below Moavis, when it says that you're not allowed to marry, a Moavi is not allowed to marry Bekal Hashem, So the Gemara says that this is only an exclusion towards a male Moavi. Even if he converts, he's not allowed to marry within the community. But it's not an exclusion to a female Moavi. So why is that? Because the Moavim were punished because they did not come out to greet us with bread and water when we were passing through their geographical territory on the way out of Mitzrayim. And therefore, since they were so stingy towards us, the Moabi men are forever excluded from being able to marry within the community. However, even if they convert, however, this was only true of the Moabi men, not the Moabi women, because it's not derech ish l'kadem, it's not the manner of women to go out into the street. So the Gemara asked, but they could have gone out into the street just to offer food and water to the women. So the Gemara answers, no, even with respect to any going out into the street, we say, kol kavuda bas melech penima, and because of this principle, kol kavuda bas melech penima, that's why Rusa Moabiyah, when she converted, was allowed to marry Boaz and was considered legitimate marriage, and since it was considered to be a legitimate marriage, therefore their offspring was legitimate, and eventually that is what enabled David HaMelech to be considered legitimate and suited to become the king, to establish Malchus Beis David. So what we find from this is that the foundation of leadership in the Jewish tradition is actually predicated upon this halacha of kol kavuda bas melech penima. So how can we possibly speak about leadership roles without reckoning with the principle of kol kavuda bas melech penima? If you take a look at the RCA resolution on page 12, this is going back to 2010. There have been many RCA resolutions following 2010 that deal with women in leadership, but none of them are really worthy of repetition because most of them come across as a little bit defensive, in my opinion, and they were addressing positions that were inappropriate for women to assume according to the guidelines of halakha that they had articulated. But as a result, some people found them to be polarizing. I don't think there was anything wrong with them, but I think that this particular statement is really the one that I think most beautifully represents the Jewish perspective towards the growth of women in the Torah learning sphere and our attitude towards it, because it's a very positive message. If you take a look, this is on page 12 of the materials, the flowering Torah study and teaching by God-fearing Orthodox women in recent decades stands as a significant achievement. We see as our sacred and joyful duty transmission of Judaism in all of its extraordinary depth and richness. In light of the opportunity created by advanced women's learning, the Rabbinical Council of America encourages a diversity of halachically and communally appropriate professional opportunities for learned, committed women in the service of our collective mission to preserve and transmit our heritage. And the caveat is, that due to our aforesaid commitment to sacred continuity, we cannot accept either the ordination of women or the recognition of women as members of the Orthodox rabbinate, regardless of the title. We'll get into that a little bit more. And this is a wonderful development within the Jewish community. What word is absent in this entire resolution that we've been speaking about? Leadership. The word leadership doesn't appear in this resolution because leadership is not something which we view as a desideratum, even for the men of the community. What we consider to be beneficial and consider to be meritorious and virtuous is contribution, being able to contribute in a halakhically appropriate way a person's talents and a person's abilities. That applies both to men and to women as appropriate. So this ties in to the discussion regarding Sarara. We have to observe the notion of Kokobuddha Basmelech Penima. Those are notions of Tznius. What about notions of Sarara? So the Rambam darshins from the Pasuk of Samta Sima Lecha Melech, Melech Lo Malka. Rambam doesn't stop there. And so to all appointments in the Jewish community, we only appoint men and we don't appoint women to those positions. So this limitation of the Rambam, where the Rambam goes beyond the queen, And he says it's not only the queen that's off, queenship that's off limits, but it would be off limits for a woman to assume any position of communal authority. So this was analyzed extensively by Rav Moshe Feinstein in two tshuvos that he wrote in Yored Chelek Beis of Yoredeya, Simen Mem Dalet, and Simen Mem Hei, specifically in the context of a woman mashkicha. Because what position is more exalted and glorious than to be a mashkiach or mashkicha? So there was a case where a woman's a widow, a rebbetzin, her husband had been a rav and he was mashkiach, and she learned a lot about the trade of how to be a mashkiach, and it was a good parnasa. Then he was nifter. And the question was that he didn't want to deprive an aman of her parnasa. Could she continue to be mashkicha? So first, the Rav Moshe defined what does it mean to say that something is sarara, that it's a communal leadership position. Rav Moshe said, whenever your job is to do neged vasam balei bayis, you're hired by a balei bayis, but it's your job not to do the bidding of the balei bayis, but to tell the balei bayis what to do, to say, you can't eat this food, you got to throw out this food in the garbage, you have to kasher this pot. This pot is made of fecheres, and it got treif, and you got to throw it in the garbage. Whenever you are the one ordering around the balei bayis, so that's considered to be a position of sarara. If a mashgiach does his job, so then it's a position of sarara. He's or borsing around the balei bayis and telling the balei bayis that you can't eat these foods, you can't use these pots, etc., etc. Says Rav Moshe, this is considered to be sarara, and therefore would be a problem according to the Rambam. But he points out not everybody agrees with the Rambam. The Sefer Achinuch indicates that sarara. The prohibition of sarara for women is limited to being a malka. How do we know that? Because when he speaks about appointing a melech, so he says, oh, one of the rules of being a melech is that it applies to only men and not women, melech or malka. Then he says, oh, and it also goes b'yerusha, but not only does the malchus go b'yerusha, but other positions of authority go b'yerusha as well. So Rav Moshe's mendayik, since here the Sefer Chinuch speaks about the impact of the halachos that he's articulating on other positions of authority, but he only said that with respect to Yerusha, but not with respect to the exclusion of a woman. Therefore, that shows that a woman is not excluded from other positions of authority. In his second shuva, Rav Moshe brought what I think is the more obvious proof, which is that in the next halacha, when Rav Moshe is speaking about how a ger, it says, is not allowed to be a king, because he's not considered to be mikerev achecha, as it says in the pasuk. So the Sefer Chinuch says, and this is true not only of a ger not being allowed to be a king, but a ger is not allowed to assume any other position of sarara. So in the immediately previous halacha, where Moshe spoke about how a woman can't be king, but Moshe did not say a woman can't assume any other position of sarara, even though Moshe said this, said that limitation with respect to a ger in the very next halacha. So that's perhaps an even more compelling proof that according to Sefer Chinuch, this limitation for a woman only applies to the kingship, it doesn't apply to other positions. So Svara Moshe demonstrates that there are other Rishonim as well, besides the Sefer Chinuch, who appear to subscribe to the same position. So says Moshe, number one, if we have a dire need for a woman to assume a position of Svara, like for example, here's for the sake of Parnassa, there's some wiggle room because we don't necessarily have to paskin like the Rambam. And number two, he said that it may not necessarily be impossible to figure out how to accommodate the Rambam. So he makes a suggestion, just have a Rav appointed who is a pro forma going to be the official Mashgiach, and this woman will be working for that Rav, and he's really the one in charge, even though she's the one who's really working day to day and making all the decisions, but it's all under the rubric of his authority. Technically speaking, she has to report to him. So if you can make it work, according to the Rambam, says the Moshe, you're obligated. He has the lashon, a strong lashon in the second shuva, that if you can make it work, even according to the Rambam, so then you're obligated to make it work, even according to the Rambam. I heard from Avraham Lichtenstein as well, when he was speaking about these issues in yeshiva a number of years ago. He was addressing Kol Elyon students. So he said that even if we don't necessarily paskin like the Rambam, according to all authorities, as a matter of communal policy, he felt it was necessary to reckon with the Rambam. So the editor of the journal HaMa'or, Meir Emzel, wrote apparently a flaming letter to Rav Moshe, just based on Rav Moshe's reaction to him in Tshuva Memhe, in which he suggested that the whole world was going to fall apart based on this tshuva that Rav Moshe had penned, because now that the cat was out of the bag, then not everybody agrees with the Rambam, and maybe under certain circumstances a woman could assume a position of sarara, and now they'll appoint a woman president of the state of Israel. He probably meant a woman, you know, prime minister of the state of Israel. And sure enough, a few years later, Golda Meir was appointed, go figure. And who knows if now they're going to make women presidents of shuls, and he just opened up a Pandora's box. So Rav Moshe said, we don't really have to worry about opening up a Pandora's box if we're just clarifying what the halacha really is. If the halacha really does provide for flexibility, so then that is something that we should all be mindful of when making decisions. When it comes to the state of Israel, he said, they don't ask a shilas anyway, so I'm not really worried about, you know, what they do. As I think Rav Soloveitchik once said when he was asked about Golda Meir being prime minister, he said, and who said that David Ben-Gurion could be prime minister, according to halacha. And as far as the question about a woman being appointed as a president of a shul, he had a very interesting lashon. He said, well, of course, that the Batei Knesset and most of the Shemesh Nagim are Piderach HaTorah, because these institutions are guided by principles of Torah, lo yasu l'horos rab mufak. They're going to turn to a rab. And therefore, they will, it's sufficient that they'll be familiar with the Shita Sarambam, Shalom Limnos Isha. Now, Amidayek, this you could say is a very nitpicky diuk, but Amidayek in the Lashon of the Rav Moshe, he didn't say Shalom Yimnos Isha, that they'll be familiar with the Shita Sarambam, so they'll be careful not to appoint a woman, but that they'll be careful to reckon with the Shita Sarambam, Shalom Limnos Isha, that the Rambam's opinion is that you're not supposed to appoint a woman to a position of authority. And they'll reckon with that opinion, and they'll figure out how to incorporate that opinion with respect to their decision, with respect to their decision making. So I don't know if he was stating a categorical prohibition, in his opinion, for a woman ever to serve as president of a shul. That I think is debatable. Reasonable minds can differ with respect to that. But he also says something else to Rabbi Amzel. He says, if you have a choice between a God-fearing woman to appoint to a position or a man who is an apikoros, so then, of course, you appoint the woman. Or you have either a man who's an oisvarf, or you have a woman who's an isha kesheva. And you got to appoint one of them. So then, of course, you have to appoint the woman. Because he said, more important than this principle of the Sarara, where we have opinions that that disagree with the Rambam altogether, is the principle that we never appoint to a leadership position somebody who lacks Yiras Shamayim. And with respect to the Malchus passes from father to son, but not, as the Gemara points out, if the son does not have Yiras Shamayim. That is an absolute prerequisite of the opinion. So that, he said, is more fundamental. In fact, Rav Avadya Yosef as well, or at least Rav Avadya Yosef's family, let's put it that way, there's a website called Halacha Yomis, which has a picture of Rav Avadya Yosef, thereby at least transmitting the implication that whatever is said is coming from Rav Avadya Yosef. So he probably didn't author this himself, but it was published during his lifetime. Im Isha Yechol Alachayin B'Tavkid Rosh Memshola Oshiesh B'Zem Miniyah Mitzad HaHalacha. So after a long discussion, he says, "Mikvala dvam nomad shemhino heges piashus v'kashus, that a sheep behaves with in a frum and fashion of yiras shemayim, oila chizal chomos adas yosim meiz ishimasig mumadaso, and she's going to raise and elevate the level of Torah observance more than a man." So then certainly we should support the selection of the woman into this position. And he says, and certainly we should never support any movement that's made up of anashim who are not Yirei Shemayim, but rather we have to always be bochev and tovas and sigim she magdilim kocha shel Torah. So this is consistent with the statement which was made by Rav Moshe Feinstein as well, that we should understand what our priorities are in terms of things that we're going to be concerned about. Ki yisharim da'achay Hashem b'sadikim yochubam rishayim yikashlubam is the pasuk that Rav Moshe quotes in this context. Now, Rav Soloveitchik seemed to feel that the Sarara limitation itself is an outgrowth to some degree, at least in terms of what you might call time of dekra, of the kavuda bas melech panima consideration of tzniyus concerns. And therefore, Rav Soloveitchik felt that the Sarara limitation for women, to the extent applicable based on the Rambam, it's also some midrashim, medrash tanoim, sikta, that the Rambam seems to be consistent with, even though Rav Moshe suggested maybe it was the Rambam's own Sarara. But Rav Soloveitchik felt that this limitation is perhaps more sweeping than other limitations of Sarara. Like, for example, we have a limitation of Sarara that a ger, is not supposed to assume positions of Sarara. But said Rav Soloveitchik, you might have certain positions that are not Sarara with his actual authority, but it's a position of a communal appointment without actual authority. What's a paradigmatic example of that? Somebody who is a shochet. So strictly speaking, first halacha in Yeridea, Machabe says a woman's allowed to shech. That's straight out of the Gemara. However, says the Ramah, but the meaning is that women don't shecht. So the question is, so therefore women shouldn't shecht because it's not the minhag. Shach quotes the question, what about lo reino eino raya? Says that we never saw that just because women don't shecht, that doesn't mean that women can't shecht. Then he says, maybe when it comes to a minhag, we would say lo reino raya, that the fact that women don't do it means that this is a minhag, that women don't shecht. So Soloveitchik said, I have a halachic explanation as to why women don't shecht. This is explained in the published shiurim of the Rav in Yeridea. It was compiled by our very own Rabbi Eliakim Konigsberg, the Rav explained that there's a sheet of the Kobo that says Shnachim Shochtos the Atzman. Women can shecht for themselves. So that might mean women, when they are allowed to shecht, they don't require supervision. But it also might mean, the way the Rav was explaining it, that women can shecht in their backyard, Shochtos the Atzman, as long as they're not shechting for the entire community. But perhaps the reason, explains the Rav, the minhag developed for women not to shecht is because it became a position of communal appointments. In fact, in many communities, the position of shochet was considered to be much more important than the position of Rav. Rav, okay, so, you know, anybody could get up and give a drasha, right? But when it comes to shochet, you got to eat meat. So you need somebody who's going to, I don't mean that really. But so therefore, when it comes to eating meat, that's something which is, you know, on some level even more compelling, that you need somebody who knows how to shecht properly so that the community will be able to eat meat. I remember I was once visiting a museum in the JCC of the Bridgeport, Connecticut community. I don't know if it's still around. I was a law student in Connecticut, so I went there once on like a field trip, and like most of the pictures and the artifacts that they had in this little mini museum in the Jewish Center about the Bridgeport community was about like all the shochtim that they had in the community over the years. Oh, and this is when so-and-so was appointed a shochet, and there's very little about the rabbanim, but mostly about the shochtim, because it's a very, very big deal to be appointed as the shochet of a community. So said Rav Soloveitchik, so once being shochet became a communal appointment, so then that becomes off-limits for women, because that's an issue of sorora. It's not off limits for Gary, said, because it's not a type of sorora. I'm sorry?
That's a problem of what?
It would be a problem of sorora, said the Rav, meaning that the idea of minoy, whenever you have a communal appointment, that's included within the prohibition of sorora for a woman. That's what Rav Soloveitchik said. As opposed to a ger could be a shochet, even though a ger is not supposed to assume positions of sorora, because it's not a position in which you're telling people what to do. There are other people, or the Rav Amakshir, and so forth, but rather simply because of the fact that it is a public position, and therefore it is a diminution in the tznius requirement for a woman in the Jewish tradition. So therefore the Rav really saw the prohibition of sorora as an outgrowth or extension on some level of the imposition of tznius norms in a heightened fashion with respect to women in the Jewish community. Now, if you hold like the Rav, of course, that even limits more an analysis of any particular position in terms of its appropriateness for women. Because with respect to any position, you can look and see, is this really sorora? So some would say, like with respect to being a shul president, well, if the type of shul presidency that we're talking about is where the president doesn't really do anything without agreement by the board, and where the president can't really make unilateral decisions on his own, so maybe then it's not really so much a position of sorora. According to the Rav, any type of public appointment automatically implicates sorora concerns, even if it would not be a position that would have any tremendous authority and strength in terms of being a figure that would be able to dictate policy to the congregation. So that's probably why Rav Shechter told me, because I was writing about this, so I added this as a footnote to an article in my sefer, if you want to, you know, read, and not that I'm, you know, looking to plug my sefer, but why not? So in Kanfei Yonah, there's a siman that I wrote about Sorora L'Nashim, so I added as a footnote that what Rav Shechter told me, that the Rav was very much, he felt categorically that a woman cannot be a shul president. I think the reason he felt this categorically was because it's a position of minoy. So even if you could define a certain type of presidency as not really implicating Sroah considerations, it would still be a minoy according to the Rav. Others who don't necessarily have this approach would look, you know, more into the other considerations. Number one, is this Sroah, does it really function as Sroah in terms of being an authority position where the president tells people what to do or can make decisions unilaterally? This was the subject of a debate between Rabbi Brisman, for the Ab Beis Din of the Philadelphia Beis Din, and his colleague, the late Rabbi Aaron Felder, Zichrono Livracha, about whether a ger could serve as a president of a shul. Rabbi Brisman said that there are certain types of congregations where it might not necessarily be such a sroa, and there's also an additional consideration with the ger that there are explicit sources based on a Gemara and Kiddushin, Daf Ayin Vav, and a Meiri, that if the ger takes a position of authority and shares it with other people, maybe that would be okay. But also, he felt that if you have a position where the president doesn't make unilateral decisions, so based on all these considerations, you can argue that it's not really Sarara. And Rabbi Felder disagreed and felt that being president of a shul is always considered to be Sarara. But that might be a debate that's only really pertinent to a ger, according to the Rav, because according to the Rav, there's a separate consideration with respect to a woman that it's an appointment of communal authority. Obviously, you would also have to take into account with a woman the very tznius consideration of what does it mean to, you know, function as a president? Are there any kind of public appearances or speeches or announcements or, you know, things of that variety that could compromise issues of tznius, crossing over the mechitza and so forth? And then you'd have the question of, is this a position in general that, or is the appointment of the woman going to further Torah v'yir shemayim as the halacha yomis of Rabbi Yosef indicates? It would be an important consideration. And also you would have the consideration of, is there nobody else, you know, who is qualified? Is there no man who's better qualified to do the job? Or is it perhaps a choice between a woman who has Yirah Shemayim and a man who is, you know, not fully observant, or, you know, not who doesn't have the requisite Yirah Shemayim? Okay, see, a couple of questions. Wait, you didn't ask yet.
Don't the Rishonim indicate not like the Rav, because they equate Yisha and Ger?
I don't see it a complete equation between Isha and Ger. There's a number of different areas of halacha where we see a distinction between Isha and Ger. We're going to discuss one of them very soon in connection with Dayanus, where there's a very clear distinction between Isha and Ger. So I don't know. I'm sorry, of Shamasimos. The Sefer Chinuch clearly distinguishes between Isha and Ger when it comes to Shamasimos. He only says Shamasimos are off limits to a Ger, not with respect to an Isha. So I don't know if it's an absolute equation. Yeah.
I bring you back for a minute. Sefer Chinuch held that Sororah is only by kingship, right? The issue of Sororah is only by king.
Right? Sefer Chinuch held that the issue of a Sororah for a woman is only by a king, but the issue of Sarara for a ger is by all other positions as well. In addition to the considerations of tznius, of Sarara, there's also the consideration of Mesora. We always have to be very circumspect whenever we introduce any innovations. If we say that there was a position or a function that women didn't serve in the past, and now we're going to consider appointing them to those functions or creating new functions, so we have to make sure that any new innovation is very, very carefully considered. The Chasam Sofer has a discussion, I have these sources on page 11, that whenever there is some new type of halakha or halakhic ruling that has to be made, so we don't want to be in a rosa lios gas libo barak shote rasha. You don't want to be gas libo barak, but be a shote, right? You'll be considered to be like an idiot. And you'll be considered to be like a Rasha, Chas v'Shalom, if you too arrogantly presume upon yourself the authority and the expertise to make these decisions. That's why we have to apply the principle of Tshuva Berov Yoetz, that it's necessary to confer with all the experts. You have to confer with all of the Gedolim, with all of the major poskim, whenever it comes to introducing an innovation, to make sure that you're thinking it through correctly, and that the ultimate result is going to be one which is beneficial to the Torah mitzvah's observance of the community. community rather than detrimental. So the Netziv, you know, distinguishes between that if you engage in Torah mitzvah shalol lishma, then it will come, you know, will become lishma eventually. So therefore, he says liolam yasa gadam Torah mitzvah sapil shalol lishma, that it's considered to be an okay thing. And yet elsewhere it says that if you're osik with Torah mitzvah shalol lishma naslo sama mavis, it becomes like a poison that causes death. So which is it? So the Netziv says that if the shalol lishma if we're talking about being mechadesh new things in Torah, so then it becomes a sam hamavis. If you're going to innovate, if with something which is an age old mitzvah and you're just doing a shalol lishma, so we know that it's a good thing. But if you're going to innovate something new and it's shalol lishma, so then it becomes a sam hamavis. So it's very, very important to make sure that everything is introduced lishma and in the most careful and deliberate possible fashion. It's similar to what the Chavos Yair wrote. Chavos Yair of Yair Bachrach was writing about a little girl who was left behind by her father, didn't have any sons. Is it appropriate for her to say Kaddish? He wanted her, you know, to be able to say Kaddish upon his Petiris. So he said that, strictly speaking, he didn't think that, you know, the Zohar source of saying Kaddish should really distinguish between sons or daughters. If it's meritorious for the deceased, for the son to say Kaddish, it could be meritorious for the daughter as well. He was talking about saying it in a home setting after a learning, you know, session in a person's house. But nonetheless, he said, Mikol Makom Yesh Lakos Sheayad Ken Yaklo Shukachom in Hagam Sheb Bnei Yisrael. We have to worry that it's going to negatively affect our Misora. You don't mess up, we mess with the Misora so quickly. And therefore, he says the minhagim she saw shegam kein torahim. V'yakolecha bone bone le'atzma pisvaraso. Everybody's just going to do their own thing based on what they think is right. Umaximili drabanan kechukav lula v'yavo legalgo bo. It's going to lead people to insult and to disparage the words of the sages and the Chachamim Midor Lador, and therefore we have to be very, very careful about any innovations as well. So these are all the considerations that have to be taken into account. This is the Chavos Yair of Yair Bachrach from a few hundred years ago. So as Rosh Hashanah says, it's Silach Bikvei Atzon. You have to always tend to the flock by going to the Gedolim to be able to shepherd the flock appropriately. I think this is why, even in the context of Torah learning, we needed the psak of the Chafetz Chaim, we needed the psak of Soloveitchik in order to establish parameters to say, even though according to the letter of the law, it was never really done in the past to have an institution which is proactively teaching Torah to young women, Chafetz Chaim said this becomes appropriate based on his application, his understanding of the application of the halacha, because it was something new. We needed the Chafetz Chaim to say that. We couldn't have done that on our own. Similarly, with respect to any schools in which it's concluded that teaching Torah Shebaal Peh in Orthodox schools could be appropriate for girls, it requires the psak of Rav Soloveitchik. It's not something that we can simply do on our own. So what about the elephant in the room? Did anybody see an elephant in the room? There was one originally, at the beginning, but I got rid of it. But there's another elephant in the room. So there's an elephant in the room, which is women rabbis. Women rabbis. So it's not really such an elephant. We just have to define what's a rabbi. I'm not going to spend too much time defining what's an elephant. So I've gotten calls in the past about Reform rabbis. Remember, one of the most difficult calls that I had to answer was regarding apparently a man who presented himself as a Reform rabbi, and he was performing intermarriages. So people were very happy because they had this rabbi who was performing marriages for them because he was a Reform rabbi, and he said he's allowed to do this, to perform intermarriages. And then it turned out that the ordination that he claimed to have was a forged ordination. He didn't really have ordination. So I remember this was one of the calls I got from a reporter when I was at the Beth Din of America. They said, what is my opinion? A lot of these couples are now very nervous that their marriages may not be legitimate. What's my opinion about the status of their marriage when, you know, the rabbi represented himself, you know, as an ordained rabbi, but it turned out he didn't really have ordination. So I realized this was not a question that I would be able to answer in any way, shape, or form, that there was just no good answer that I could give to the reporter. So therefore, I just dodged. It's the only time that I dodged a reporter. I've always been a very good reporter's call. I answer their questions, whatever it is. This is the one call I did not return because I just could not handle it. So it's a similar question. Somebody says, can a woman be a reform rabbi? So that's assuming that a man can be a reform rabbi. We take the status... And the title of rabbi very, very seriously, that it is a continuation on some level of the smicha that was originally conferred by Moshe Rabbeinu upon Yeshua, the smicha that we've had throughout the generations, even though that official smicha, ish mipi ish, from Moshe Rabbeinu came to an end during the Chachmei HaTalmud. Nonetheless, we wouldn't have an institution of smicha and calling people rabbi altogether if we were not trying on some level to perpetuate that institution and to have a proper similarity to the original smicha. And that's why the Shuas Ramah says, the Aruch HaShulchan says, Tosfos and Kitten, Pei Chesem HaBei say, that we function in terms of our own smicha in a form of Shtichu Sayo de Kamaika of Dinan, that we view ourselves as the successors of the original Dayanim, even if we don't necessarily have the same full-fledged authority that they had. That is really the premise of what smicha is all about. And the Rambam says, Ketzari Asmicha L'Doros, Lo Sheyisrucha Yedein Rosh HaZaken, and not that you just place your hands on the head of the Zaken, of the rabbinic figure, Ela Shekoin Lo Rebbe. Smicha means you call somebody rabbi. For Omim Lo, what does it mean to call somebody rabbi? You tell them, Areyat Samok, you have the smicha, which is the authority that smicha is always supposed to confer, and you have the ability to serve as a dayan. Smicha was really for the purpose of enabling people to have the credentials where they could at least theoretically serve as a dayan, even if that's not the actual function. That is the understanding and the underpinning of giving smicha, that we should perpetuate that possibility, that potential, that institution of dayanus. But the halakha is unequivocal. In Choshe Mishpah, at the beginning of Siman Zayin, Isha Psula Ladun. A woman cannot serve as a dayan. She simply cannot. It may be based upon the fact that a woman can't serve as an aide, if you can't serve as an aide, you can't serve as a dayan. Yerushalmi has gzeiros hakasuv that a woman cannot serve as a dayan. So therefore, for this reason alone, when we speak about anything in the realm of rabbi, when we speak about anything in the realm of smicha, when we speak about rabbi, anything of that sort, as that connotes the ability to serve as a dayan. For that reason alone, I think that this particular issue is clearly off the table, that the women are out of the parshas. Like Rashi says in the beginning, in Parshas Dvarim, when Moshe was told to appoint dayanim, avu lachem anashim chachamim, so Rashi says, anashim, why do you have to say men? Bechila sale al datka anashim? Would anyone have a haba meaning that we're speaking about women? It's just not something women aren't in the parsha. Even when we relax some of the rules of a bezdin, like for hataras nedarim, could be done belightly, could have krovim. Rabbi Kiba Eger says in Yeridan, Hilchos Nedarim, that a woman can't serve on a bezdin for hataras nedarim because she's simply excluded from this realm, from this universe of being a dayan, and therefore is excluded from the realm of serving as a rabbi. But that doesn't mean that we can't explore the possibility of other positions, that we have to be so incredibly dogmatic. We have to really just figure out what are the positions and what is the proper framework that, number one, fits within the considerations and concerns regarding Sarara, Tznius, and Misora, and at the same time is also something which clearly is L'Shem Shemayim and would further the observance of Torah and Yerush Shemayim and all of these fundamental principles rather than to compromise them. So specifically, what about a woman being a poseket? She's learned a lot of halacha. Can she paskin a shayla? So Tosas asked the kasha about Devorah. How could Devorah have been a dayan altogether? So he says, one answer is, well, maybe it's okay, but that's rejected lahalacha, as we pointed out. But the other answers Tosfos gives is that, well, maybe Devorah was an exception because she was appointed al pishchina. But then he gives another answer. He says, well, maybe she wasn't the dayan. You had other men who were serving as the dayanim, But she was Haisa Malamis, Malamedis Lamdinim. She just was very learned, and she would teach the laws, and then people would figure out what to do. Tosas in Yavamos uses the lashon Haisa Malamedis Lamdinim Sheyadunu. She taught them dinim so that the dayanim would know how to paskin. She was an advisor on some level towards the dayanim, and based on this, the Piskei Tshuva and Siman Zayin Chosha Mishpah quotes the Chidah, the Birkei Yosef, on this basis that a woman could theoretically paskin. A woman could theoretically paskin. Shari Tshuva is more limiting, says maybe a woman can clarify facts of a case that enable it, but the Chidah says a learned woman could paskin. Brings a raya from the Sefer Chinuch. Sefer Chinuch talks about how you're not allowed to paskin when you're drunk. I did not drink anything before this year. Don't worry. But you're not allowed to paskin when you're drunk. And the Sefer Chinuch says that this halakha applies not only to men, but also applies to women. Women also are not allowed to paskin when they're drunk. The implication is that if they're not drunk, they can paskin, assuming that they're learned enough, right? Okay, it's not that if you don't know anything, you just go out and get drunk, and as soon as, you know, you become sober again, you can start paskin. You have to know something, too. But assuming that whether speaking about a man or a woman, that they are learning and they really know Torah, so then, theoretically, they would be able to paskin. But paskining is not necessarily the same thing as having an appointment. Like, throughout the centuries, there have been learned rebbetzins who, when people in the community call up and they ask a shayla, you know, what happens if I forgot Yala V'yobo or something like that? So the rebbetzin, if she knows the answer, so she, you know, might feel comfortable answering the question. But she's not necessarily appointed to a public position the same way that her husband was appointed. According to the Rav, if you appointed a woman to a position that was posekit, it could still potentially be problematic. However, you could argue that maybe even according to the Rav, if we say that the entire issue is that it's an outgrowth of tznius concerns, so maybe tznius concerns is mostly when a woman is assuming a position of authority over men in the community. And she's out there in the public sphere, okay? But if she's not so much out there in the public sphere, but is in much more of a private domain, just dealing with women, so maybe that would be less of a concern. Rabbi Konigsberg has in a footnote to his Sefer, if you have a woman who's a menahelet of a school that's made up of girls and young ladies, so maybe that's not a smaller concern because of the fact that it's just a woman who is supervising other women. Lev Aryeh, Rav Aryeh Grossner said he doesn't think it matters even if a woman is just supervising other women. It's still a smaller concern, but I think you could make an argument that if the entire problem is maybe on some level predicated upon tznius, particularly when dealing with other positions, so maybe when in a type of context in which it helps to preserve and even helps to promote tznius to have a woman in a particular position, so maybe that could even make sense. Just like in the home, the woman is the akeres habayis, what I refer to as the srara of sara, right? As Rashi says, alakumish ain't srara, ain't sara, elalashan srara. So there is some appropriate sphere of srara. You can argue maybe within the sphere of the home where the woman plays the role of transmitting Torah value, shma bini musa avicha ve'alti tosh, Torah simecha. So you could perhaps then say that maybe in the area of Taras and Mishpacha, where there is a heightened concern of the tznius of the women, where women have always played a pivotal role, it still remains appropriate for them to do so. Like, for example, we know based on the Gemara and Sota that the women, they basically were directing the reproductive efforts in Mitzrayim in order to keep Klal Yisrael going by encouraging their husbands to have more children. The Gemara tells us how the women were instrumental in creating our current system of always having Zayin Nekim, Afilu Imroz, Tipos Dam Kechardo, that came from the Benos Yisrael, that particular observance. So therefore, it could be that Tznius concerns maybe Davka dictate that women should be more involved. It happens, but the same Rabbi Amzel, who wrote this letter to Rav Moshe, complaining about his tshuva regarding the women mashkichot, also wrote an essay. This is in like the collected essays. He was the editor of HaMa'or. This is in an English volume, which is like collected essays of HaMa'or in English. And one of the essays in that volume is his complaining about this newfangled institution known as kala teachers. So where did this come from? This kala teacher business. A woman gets married, let her go to her mother-in-law, she'll tell her what to do. Why are they suddenly, you know, creating this new thing known as kala teachers? So kala teachers just persevere. Nobody now looks at a kollel teacher and says, oh, what a terrible compromise of our Mesorah and our foundational values that we have kollel teachers. We pretty much accept that, of course, there should be kollel teachers. It's more appropriate to have a woman sitting down with young kollels and teaching them these halakos. So these types of positions can evolve within the framework of halakha, coupled with the needs of the community. So this leads to the whole Yoetz and Halakha question. So here again, we would have to analyze, number one, are there Sroah concerns? So if you have a position which is created, which is clearly subordinate to a Rav who's supervising the person, so then that would help to obviate the Sroah concerns, even taking into account the Rambam, if there is a feeling that there's a compelling need for the position, as Rav Moshe writes in the context of Mashkicha. Number two, you'd have to make sure that Tznias concerns were preserved. Well, it could be. Maybe Tznias concerns could even be promoted in terms of giving women an outlet to be able to discuss certain issues where there might be a compromise of Tznias to discuss certain things in the first instance anyway with men, as opposed to having a woman that she can confide in, and then of course so it could be brought to the Rav in a fashion which would comport to the standards of Tznias. And finally, Mesorah, which requires, you know, careful thought. Is this something that fits within the Mesorah? Is it something that would be harmless and productive, and even productive, like kollel teachers? Or are we worried about slippery slopes, that people won't be able to distinguish between Yoetzet Halakha and other positions that have more of a rabbinic title, which would clearly be off limits? Are we worried about intentions? Is everybody, you know, the Shem Shemayim? Are we worried about that there might be too much paskening going on? Because as Rosh Hashanah says, nobody should really paskin. Like the Rav would give smicha and say, oh, just, you know, one condition, don't paskin. Are we worried that, you know, that in order to paskin properly, you really have to know Kol HaTorah Kula, not just, you know, specialization in one area? But others feel that this can, if it's done properly at least, it can really promote the Taras Mishpacha and also the birth of more children, for that matter. Much really depends upon the community and their needs and their concerns and how the leadership of any particular community feels. The reality is that we, the rabbinic leadership, the reality is that we all recognize the need for kollel teachers, we all recognize the need for mikvah attendants, and we all recognize the need for nashim bodkot, the women who, you know, do physical examinations when appropriate of women who have nita questions. So it may just really be a question of the title, the framework, and the proper context of this type of a role in a given community. Could be that in certain communities, they're best served with kollel teachers perhaps playing a more expansive role, if necessary, to meet the role, to the needs of the women, without being called Yoetzet Halakha per se. There isn't anything magical about the title. What's more important is to, once we're outside of the rabbinic area, it's just much more important to preserve all of the halakhic considerations and sensibilities. And you can't take anything for granted. People could make mistakes. I remember that I was once consulted. I was asked the question. I thought it was a good question. Somebody said, according to those rabbanim who are supportive of Yoetzet Halakha, so is it, can a Yoetzet Halakha paskin on a marev, for example? So I said, well, it's interesting because, you know, the Chida, after all, says that a woman could, under certain circumstances, paskin. On the other hand, the Gemara talks about how even Yalta brought maros, you know, to the rabbanim of the community, and the and Gemara in Maseches Brachos speaks about how David HaMelech was steeped with, you know, his legs in blood because he was checking, you know, all of the placentas and the fetal sacs of the women to paskin nida shiloh. So it seemed like this is something that always was brought to the rabbanim. So I decided that since Rav Aaron Lichtenstein was known as somebody who was favorably inclined towards the creation of this position, I'm not saying he ever wrote anything, but he was known to be favorably inclined. So I decided I would ask Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. So I went to Rav Aaron Lichtenstein. It was the last year of his life. But it was a very good meeting. We spoke about a variety of different, you know, issues and concerns facing the community. It was really a wonderful session. I was there with Dov Carroll, who was the Misharis for Rav Aaron Lichtenstein, and he told me afterwards, like, wow, that was an amazing, it really was like an amazing meeting. So so I asked Rav Aaron this this question, and Rav Aaron said that he knew the women who were Yoetzot Halakha. He was talking in the framework of Eretz Yisrael, and it was inconceivable to him that they would ever paskin on Amara without showing it to a Rav. So I took that as an indication that Rav Aaron Lichtenstein felt that, yeah, it was appropriate always to show this sort of thing about. We do have a Mesorah. At some point, you have to go to the Gedolim of the generation, and those are Osek and the Inyanim, in order to get a good sense of what the Mesorah is. You can't just assume things on your own, even if you have a halakhic source for it. He said, no, it would not really make it proper. According to the way that I understood him, it would not be proper for the women, even if they were qualified, Yoratzot Talakha, to paskin Amaras on their own. So these are, everything has to be done in terms of the guidelines. The same thing with respect to the whole Bruhaha regarding partnership, Minyanim, and the like. I'll take your question in just a moment. Just want to, you know, get in, like, you know, all of the juicy stuff. So in terms of having some type of a Torah reading where, you know, you'll have women with aliyot and figure out, you know, some framework to do it. So we also have to subscribe to what the halakha is. It's interesting. The OU appointed a number of Y.U. Rashi Yeshiva to sit down and others and to figure out parameters of some of these issues. And they wrote a whole big, you know, memo and halakhic brief regarding these issues. But what really struck me as very much on the point that was on the last page, I think it was actually the last sentence of their entire presentation, is they were really wrestling with the issues, because you want to have sensitivity, and at the same time, it's also important to be very careful when dealing with the trailblazing new halakhic territory. And what they wrote is, it is through the medium of halakha and Torah ethos that we find liberty and exaltation in surrendering ourselves to the divine will. It's ultimately about surrendering ourselves to the divine will. If we're not prepared, like the Benos Slavka, to start off surrendering ourselves to the divine will, we have no right to be engaged in these discussions altogether. So the Gemara says in Megillah Daf Chav Gimel that kol olam minyan shiva, rafilu katan rafilu isha. Technically, a woman sounds like could be called up for an aliyah. Aval amu chachamim lo tikva, isha lo tikva b'tavim b'nei kavod atzibur. But the chachamim said a woman should not get an aliyah because of kavod hatzibur. Because the kavod hatzibur, the Bach in Siman Nun Gemel and Orach Chaim says kavod hatzibur is not waivable. You can't have the tzibur say, oh, well, we decided that our kavod is that it's okay for women to have an aliyah. No, it doesn't work that way. Once something has objectively been defined as kavod hatzibur, so then it becomes non-negotiable. Zalman Nechemya Goldberg has a long essay about this with respect to the question of women receiving sheva brachos, which he gives technical halakhic issues, why you require a minyanist, of a shebikdusha, you can't have a woman, therefore, you know, serve in order to discharge the others of the obligation in terms of sheva brachos. But then he says, regardless of that, when you look at the way the Rambam brought down this halacha, the Rambam skipped the first half of the sentence where it says, Hakol olam minyan shiva, aval amu chachamin lo tikva b'torah, ish lo tikva l'torah. Says the Rambam just starts with the second half of the phrase, that this is the psak of the chachamim, isha lo tikva b'torah. It's not like there's a fallback option that in certain circumstances you have a woman get an aliyah. No, you never have a woman get an aliyah. This is what we call a non-negotiable halacha, and therefore, from the perspective of partnership, a minyanim, as well as Rabbi Schwartz said, Rabbi Gedalia Dov Schwartz was asked the question about partnership minyanim, and he said very clearly that halakhically and intuitively, he's using again his knowledge of Kol HaTorah Kula to be able to access Torah intuitions, halakhically and intuitively, it goes beyond the boundaries of communal Torah observance, and therefore is not something that can be allowed. It's something that has been considered by Gedolim. It's something which has halakhically been very carefully analyzed, and the answer is, it runs against this fundamental principle. We have to know where to draw the limits, where to draw the boundaries. At the same time, we also have to know where there is flexibility and where there is a movement to enable women to realize their potential, their ability to contribute to the community in a way that's halakhically sound, and even in a way which is halakhically beneficial. So that's why you have to consider, even in the Taras HaMishpacha realm, how that could be accomplished in a way that really does further principles of tznius. What about a woman who really desperately wants to be able to say Kaddish and feel that connection after she has lost a parent? So the Chavis Das said, technically speaking, it's permissible, but he's worried about being machlish min hagi Yisrael. So Yosef Eliyahu Henkin wrote an essay about this, and he said, you know what? If it's something that's really going to strengthen the Torah observance of and inspire the daughter, and she's somebody who anyway comports herself in a way that brings honor to her parent, the way she dresses, the way she speaks, the way she keeps mitzvahs, so then if she's going to say Kaddish in the women's section at the same time that a man is saying Kaddish in the men's section, Efshar Shenk Peda. So it's possible that, you know, that wouldn't be so terrible. Rapenkin says this. So once Rapenkin says it's possible it won't be so terrible, naturally, so that made it mutter. So, again, Rapenkin knew what he was doing. He was saying you have to be cautious about these things, but of course, Efshar Shenk Peda, he knew he was unleashing the fact that people would start relying upon him. But Rav Aaron Soloveitchik wrote very interestingly, he said, you know what? Once it is something which is mutter and is something that has been considered by the Gedolim as being mutter under, you know, these types of circumstances, so he said that in order to disallow something like that, when it means you might lose the millennials, so to speak, when it means that somebody might leave the congregation, they're going to be beyond the curtain and you're not going to see them, you're not going to bring them back to within the curtain, so said Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, then you should be maker, then you have no right to be machmir under those circumstances. It's a double-edged sword. So you have to be so careful about these things. You can't resolve all the problems by saying we're just going to usher everything. You're going to lose people, and you're going to also lose families that otherwise could have been built by women who would have had an appreciation for Torah and Yiras Shemayim in building families. You have to make sure to have the requisite flexibility when it's going to lead to a greater realization of a Torah fulfillment. And you have this dynamic, you have this discussion in a host of different areas. We only have 3 minutes to go, so I'll just, you know, quickly I'll take you through a couple, but no, it's more important to take a question. Go ahead.
When we say asking Maros, I remember 1 year old said that came to speak class said that the easy questions are like are not the shadows and all shall pass and should only bring questionable ones. So
anytime that a person has a question so that they feel they need to submit the maror altogether, so that's already a serious question. In other words, that already, in my opinion, if you're asking me, this is again my opinion, but we don't distinguish between different questions of maror. So anytime the maror is submitted because it's a question, so then that requires a rav to review. That's my understanding. So you have the same discussion, for example.
Let's continue because we don't finish up.
So for example, in the realm of bat mitzvah, so Moshe Feinstein was asked about bat mitzvah celebrations appropriate, and he said, you know, Rishonim and Mitzvarim, I don't care for the bar mitzvah celebrations, the way that, you know, that they were certainly done and that he observed in his time. So he said a birthday party is okay, but he didn't think that there was any kind of a mitzvah component to have a bat mitzvah celebration for a woman who comes of age to perform mitzvahs. On the other hand, Ravadi Yosef pointed out in the Sephardic tradition, there was a clear mesorah that since a woman, when she turns 12, a girl turns 12, becomes a woman, she becomes mitzvah ve'oseh, she becomes obligated in mitzvos, in, you know, vast majority of mitzvos, she's obligated to perform mitzvos, so then that is a cause for celebration, and they always celebrated on that basis. So where there wasn't the concern that anybody was trying to change or alter the mitzvah, he was very comfortable with it. And the Sri Deyesh said, well, even if it wasn't done before, if it is something that's going to promote the Torah Yiras Shemayim of a woman, don't do it in a shul, like Moshe said, don't do it the birthday party in the shul, but he said you could do it in the social hall of the shul. So he already allowed for a little bit of leeway so that the principles of Mesorah would not be compromised, while at the same time, Torah principles would be elevated in terms of encouraging the woman to a lifetime of Torah and mitzvot. So, you know, as Rabbi Tversky points out, there shouldn't be practices done in the bat mitzvah that are things that the woman can't, you know, do for the rest of her life. It should be a bat mitzvah in the spirit of what's going to be the nature of a wholesome Torah observance for the rest of for the rest of one's life. Coming up, since it's almost Purim, so we have women's kriyas and Megillah. Here you have, you know, a machlokas between different shitas. The Bahag says a woman can't be motzi men. She has an obligation to hear. Men have an obligation to read. Question is, can a woman be motzi other women? So here the Kor Minasano bases himself on a Tosfos that says Zilu Mimilsa, that for a woman to be motzios harabim is problematic. It's considered to be a lack of tznias. Therefore, he says he's a against it. On the other hand, if you look in the Aruch HaShulchan and certain others, it doesn't seem like they necessarily adopted the Korban Nisanos understanding of Tosfos. In all of these matters, one has to figure out what is, you know, the appropriate course that should be followed in a given shul setting, in a given communal setting, based on what the objectives are, based on what the poskim of that community you have to say, and based on what are going to be the ultimate results of a certain, you know, practice in terms of furthering Torah mitzvahs, furthering a Torah-oriented agenda, or, you know, chas v'shalom going in a different direction. And I think that everyone has to be respectful of the determinations that are made by the Gedolei Poskim when it comes to these areas, because there's the halacha and there's the meta halacha, and there is the need of in order to make sure that we observe the Torah and that we are able to take advantage of women's learning, of women's, you know, interest in contributing to the community in the way that is most beneficial to our community and that also furthers the cause of Torah and mitzvos and Yiras Shemayim. And of course, we have to speak to the Nashim Tzidkaniyos Shebechol Dor V'Dor, you know, because that's just like Nashim Tzidkaniyos Shebechol Dor V'Dor were the ones that Biskar Nashim Tzidkaniyos Shebechol Dor V'Dor Negali Yisom Mitzrayim. In their merit, we were able to be taken out of Egypt. So we have to turn to the Nashim Tzidkaniyos of every generation and ask them of their view of what are the parameters of the positive possibilities and also the pitfalls, so that we can come to the correct and responsible determination when it comes to these shilas. Okay.